I'm quoting here, "Now let it therefore be it resolved that the South Dakota legislature urges that instruction in the public schools relating to global warming include the following. One, that global warming is a scientific theory rather than a proven fact. Two, that there are a variety of climatological, meteorological, astrological, thermological, cosmological, and ecological dynamics that can affect world weather phenomena."
If a Martian were to make judgments on the peoples of Earth based on their responses to polled questions, that Martian might possibly conclude that the average US citizen has the intellectual ability somewhat below that of a concussed baboon, and that the average Israeli would like to see all Palestinians strangled at birth. But the people of the United States, USAians, and the people of Israel are just that, people. Sure, there are extremists, more than in most countries, I dare say, but average people are, by definition, just average people. Why, then, do polls continually show that Israelis favour extreme policy positions which amount to poorly disguised genocide? Equally, why do polls suggest that people in the US hold beliefs suggestive of extreme mental degradation? Are they reacting so violently against the very concept of evolution that their genes, in response, are sending them back the other way? I'm not really interested in this commentary in rehearsing the well-covered topics of US anti-intellectualism and its political uses, nor the equally well-covered ground of Israeli extremism and its strategic utility. In this commentary, I will discuss the following. 1. How US mass miseducation fuels an elitist delusion of broader strategic stupidity in US leaders and institutions, which is a form of apologism. 2. How Israeli Hasbara, or public diplomacy, creates a hermetically sealed information environment for Israeli citizens. And 3. What the current state of mass and elite delusion tells us compared with, for example, Soviet-era propaganda. Part 1. Stupid Americans. The subject of the widely alleged stupidity of US Americans, or USAians, is one close to my heart. When reading analyses of major US interventions in Korea, Indochina, and Iraq, there are few analysts who claim that the US acted out of a genuine security need. There are others who say that they did it to make money. Both of these are demonstrably untrue, as the interventions cost money and created insecurity not just at the macro level, but as a policy tendency almost without exception in every arena from waste disposal to aerial bombardment to international diplomacy. Most, therefore, explain matters in the only other way their teeny tiny brains can cope with. Americans are just plain stupid. The stupidity and arrogance attributed to the US is sometimes characterized as misguided attempts to bring democracy to people. Thus, although it was the US which prevented the unified elections in Vietnam and gave support to blatantly rigged Republic of Vietnam elections, many authors see US idealistic attempts to bring enlightenment and democracy as arrogant because they were dealing with people who were culturally or racially indisposed towards freedom and human rights. Equally, Even though Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority tried to prevent elections in Iraq, many people see US intervention in Iraq as a misguided crusade to spread democracy. Yeah, right. The alleged naive and/or arrogant stupidity of US people is exactly the same excuse for violent, deadly imperialism as the bungling of the British, who acquired an empire in, quote, a fit of absence of mind. In the US case, analyses of policy are replete with words such as unintended, reckless, heedless, and misguided. The US doesn't commit aggression, it gets sucked into quagmires. Often in perfectly well-respected analyses by pillars of the academic community, there is the central cunning oriental figure of a local such as Syngman Rhee or Ngo Dinh Diem that, shock, horror, uses US military might for their own domestic agenda. Even Ahmed Chalabi has been cast in this role. Yet each one of these gentlemen was the creation of US intelligence, without whom they could not wield even the smallest amount of power. Very few empires in history are characterized by equilibrium, and the US empire is most emphatically not one of them. Most empires are pathologically expansionist. They expand and, at some point, begin to rot from within because imperial elites have interests as distinct from those of the center as they do from those of the periphery. What I mean by that is that, for example, if you have a US imperial elite, they not only don't care about their neo-colonies and the people in their neo-colonies, they also no longer have interests tied to the United States as a nation-state, nor its people. At some stage, however, imperial expansion stops, and they either collapse quickly or go into a fitful death spiral. The expansion, however, does not happen without the will and intention of powerful individuals. I'm saying that this is not simply a structural matter. The separation between structure and agency is somewhat of a delusion in any respect. But imperial expansion requires both. There must be a structure, which is imperial, and there must be the imperial agents that that positively desire imperial expansion for whatever ends, ideological or material. For an empire to expand, the extent and depth of its power and control requires that powerful individuals desire that outcome. In the US, they will often make clear such designs in journals or white papers and, not uncommonly, write in the open in the mass print media, somewhat less so in the broadcast media. Yet, when the prescribed actions are actually undertaken, very, very few people characterize the victims of the resultant mass violence as being assaulted, maimed, and murdered by those who had openly advocated an extension of imperial power which, of necessity, could only be achieved through the very mass violence in question. Instead, they seek answers elsewhere, in the rhetoric of idealism or the impersonal structures of a deterministic economic model. Either way exonerates the perpetrators, and the tendency to exonerate on the grounds of idealistic intent should be of no surprise whatsoever. It shouldn't surprise us that people see US aggression as botched attempts to do good, because the very first thing that an imperialist sets about doing before enacting mass violence in the pursuit of imperial expansion is to find a cover story that is A, emotive, and B, morally righteous. This is normal. This is what those who would wage war do, even those who in the very next breath might be extolling their martial prowess, their expansionist destiny, and the racial superiority of their people. They always seek the humanitarian excuse for acting upon those things. This is where we begin to return to US stupidity and Israeli extremism. You see, for a long time, at least as far back as Thucydides, people aware of the insincerity of professed idealism among aggressors, have taken it as evidence that all polities will maximize the power they wield in their own self-interest, regardless of the cost in blood and pain to others. I think the reasoning is something along the lines of, if Athens did it, if Rome did it, if Britain did it, if France and the US, if these epitomes of human advancement act like rabid, mass-murdering psychopaths, then it must be inevitable that all polities will if they gain such power. This was actually a major component of the Nazi rationalization of their own imperialist genocides. This ignores the costs, of course, those polities which do not at any given time harbour imperial ambitions and acts. This acts yet again to exonerate the imperial aggressors. It also misses the more important lesson to be drawn from the practice of lying in order to enact aggression. That lesson is that the lies are necessary. Not only are the lies necessary, but it is necessary that a reasonable portion believe the lies. You might be able to see where I'm going with this, but let's just pause to reflect on what sort of lies I'm talking about. In a recent commentary, I discussed atrocity propaganda, such as Nouriel El-Sabah's tearful testimony about brutally killed Kuwaiti newborns. This is typical, but unsophisticated. Going forward in time, 12 and a half years later, Colin Powell used his sobriety in exactly the same way that Nouriel had used her tears. But that wasn't the real lie. The lie of the Iraq invasion and the subsequent occupation, i.e. phase 2 of the Iraq genocide, had to be more enduring. The real lie of the Bush and Blair governments was that they believed their own lies. It was known from very early on that they were consciously attempting to deceive, and presumably as a fallback after being found out, they simply caused the media, by whatever mechanism, to emphasize over and over again Blair's innate sincerity, the neoconservatives' fanaticism, and, not least, Bush's stupidity. Somehow, in a rather scary feat of thought control, they managed to actually sell the idea that these people had consciously created a systematic deception and then, through some unmentioned but clearly bizarre mechanism, had fallen victim to their own lies. You have probably guessed that I'm going to suggest that the poll results which show, for example, that 57% of voting age US citizens believe in demonic possession, or that ever-increasing numbers think that Obama is a Muslim, or polls showing that 84% of Israelis support the latest assault on Gaza and 70% oppose the ceasefire in a country that is 20% Palestinian, or polls that show that most Israelis believe they are practicing apartheid and most support apartheid policies, leading Gideon Levy to write, quote, "Israelis themselves are openly, shamelessly, and guiltlessly defining themselves as nationalistic racists." You're probably thinking that I'm going to say it is because of the informational environment in which these populations live their lives that they develop such notable opinions. And of course, I do believe that is the case. You might, however, be beginning to wonder, am I suggesting that the whole thrust of the mass miseducation in the US is to produce such convincing appearance of national stupidity as to provide cover for any and all conceivable war crimes and crimes against humanity? Would I suggest that? No, I wouldn't. Not at all. It's actually just a serendipitous circumstance. It's very felicitous from an imperialist point of view, because the people that you have to convince that US leaders are stupid includes those willfully responsible for the miseducation of the masses. By that I mean, of course, the more educated folks, the journalists and the academics and so forth. But I'll get to that soon. 63% of Republican respondents still believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when the US invaded in 2003. I can't find any polls on whether people in the US think that Iran is making a nuclear weapon, only ones that say what they think the US response to that assumed nuclear weapons program should be. In October 2012, 56% of respondents said they favor Washington taking a, quote, firm stand, end quote, with Iran, while 41% said, quote, it is more important to avoid military conflict, end quote. Some people might actually claim outright that Iran is building a nuclear weapon, such as Benjamin Netanyahu, who predicted an Iranian bomb by 1997 back in 1992, and hasn't let up predicting Iranian bombs since that time. Most, however, know that they can't make such a claim, but they like to act as if it were established truth, and by nuance and implication can give an audience or readership that impression. What faith is it that causes them to promulgate as truth something for which they have no evidentiary basis? The faith that peace-loving, enlightened, noble, and Nobel-worthy US leaders have a problem with Iran, and if so, it is either because they have secret knowledge of the real Iranian plan, which may involve nuclear weapons, but must involve something equally bad like terrorism, or genocide, or nuclear terror genocide, or militant networked cyberspace nuclear terror genocide against their own people. The real secret is that if the masses are stupid, then the educated classes are incredibly goddamn stupid, and then some. I would bet, for example, that whilst the uneducated may either believe or disbelieve claims of Syrian chemical weapons threats, it takes considerable education to swallow Leon Panetta's claims that the latest intelligence indicates that Syria has somehow slowed its threat to use chemical weapons against its own people. The funny thing is that Panetta never explicitly said anything so silly as Syria has slowed some sort of sarin gas production line or something. He merely used that tried and trusted method of vagueness, hinting at certain things as being unsayable, and the media outlets did their jobs with headlines like, quote, Panetta says chemical threat has slowed, end quote. The media employees responsible for this are not of the great unwashed masses. Famously, it was found that viewers of Fox News were more likely to hold three misperceptions than viewers of other news sources. I believe that the right questions would yield similar results for the New York Times, or for the BBC, or for The Economist. Further, I believe that the right questions would point to the same sort of thing for university graduates. Two of the questions asked of Fox viewers were relating not to reality directly, but to what had been demonstrated or established. So they were asking them, has it been proven that such and such is the case, when it hadn't been proven? And Fox viewers would often say it had been proven. Now, try, for example, asking people whether there is direct historical evidence that North Korea fired first in the Korean War. Now, even if the don't knows are the majority, when they were excluded, I guarantee that the more educated the group asked, the greater percentage will answer wrongly. In a similar vein, one could ask people about the first Tonkin Gulf incident. And the more educated the respondent, the more inaccurate their response is likely to be. Typically, as a bit of an aside here, typically education acts to problematize the unproblematic, creating the same sort of fallacious balance which permeates the mainstream media. It creates a sense of privileged knowledge, which is a channel through which officialdom can reveal the sort of things that the proles wouldn't really get. Victims of this form of miseducation are liable to counter-assertions with a clear moral implication, such as an accusation of aggression or genocide, with a haughty, well, actually, followed by the received wisdom imparted by someone who they consider to be unimpeachably prestigious and possessed of secret erudition. For some, that might be Samuel Huntington. For others, who might completely revile Huntington, it could be Juan Cole. But to me, it all looks very much the same. Part 2. Fungal Societies. On the On Genocide blog, I recently posted footage from the Electronic Intifada website of a right-wing counter-demo in support of Israel's attack on Gaza, where, among many words of obscene vitriol, the entire group danced while chanting, "Death to Arabs!" I also posted testimony from a former member of the Israeli occupation forces, where he described how his comrades, quote, enjoyed seeing the misery, end quote, of the impoverished Palestinians whom they were brutalizing. This is a very frightening level of hatred and dehumanization. These are scary, scary people with very deadly weapons. But we should really be asking what forces have created them. Military personnel are a very special case. I won't deny that there are those in the military who take honour very seriously, and I won't deny that military personnel are ordinary people who, in one way or another, have consciences just like the rest of us. What I will point out is that the most grotesque acts of violence in this world are almost exclusively carried out by military personnel. We may have been conditioned to look for religious fanaticism or primitive tribalism as a cause of brutality, but if one were to take almost any given atrocity, such as, say, killing babies and toddlers, then the number one statistical predictor will inevitably be prior military indoctrination with current serving status just behind. To get a sense of what can come from the combination of training to kill and a military culture of chauvinist superiority and exclusiveness, combined with a healthy dose of nationalistically informed racism, simply read Neil Shane's Afghanistan, A Gathering Menace. And in the transcript of this talk at the On Genocide blog, I have hyperlinks to that and many of the other articles mentioned in this commentary. Now, there isn't room here to discuss the multitude of important aspects to the current processes of military indoctrination, which, whether successful or not, are probably best understood as ways of turning military personnel into murderers. What is worth contemplating, however, is that it was found that a veteran battalion stationed in Colorado Springs had a murder rate 114 times that of the surrounding community. That is a dramatic example, I think, but it demonstrates quite well that the line between allegedly lawful killing, as soldiers are trained to commit, and murder is not that distinct. As a brief aside here, the distinction between killing and murder does exist on both the level of personal morality and at a legal level. However, modern US and Israeli military practice is to attempt to efface moral judgments and to replace them with a formalism with regards to what is claimed to be legitimate under given rules of engagement, etc. In many instances, this is quite blatantly in contravention of international humanitarian law, and these are clear cases of murder from a moral standpoint also. Anyway, depending on the manner of measurement, Israel is either the most militarized state on the planet or the second most, after the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has a higher percentage rate of currently serving personnel out of its population, but in every other respect is, in fact, less militarized than Israel. Military personnel aren't just more violent than civilians as a whole, they're also more misinformed. Military personnel are the original archetype of those referred to figuratively as mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed bullshit. Among those US military personnel serving in Iraq in 2006, 6, for example, a poll found that, quote, 85% said the US mission is mainly to retaliate for Saddam's role in the 9/11 attacks. 77% said that they also believe the main or a major reason for the war was to stop Saddam from protecting al-Qaeda in Iraq, end quote. Israel and the US have both been turned into fungal societies. I guess that in the US we cannot be surprised in some senses, given that of their news media, only a select few organs are reputable enough to be compared with the Soviet-era Pravda. And it has become ever more acceptable to devote greater and greater space to editorializing in the midst of news and current affairs reporting. In Israel, though, it is often pointed out that the media are less constrained and more balanced. A cynic would point out that this alleged freedom seems to be concentrated in Haaretz rather disproportionately. A cynic might also point out that having 1 million Palestinian citizens and being extremely proximate to the occupied territories, it would be impossible for the Israeli media to be as one-sided as the US media has traditionally been. It is, therefore, a little hard at first to understand how the country of Amir Ahas and Gideon Levy produces individuals such as the young Israeli who approached me about 18 months ago. In her world, everything was the opposite of what I understood to be true. Every week in Israel, people are killed by Gazan rockets. Palestinians kill their own people in front of news cameras just to make Israelis look bad. Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East, the embodiment of all that is liberal, moderate, and tolerant, expends great effort in curtailing extremist settlers, even ripping them from their homes in Gaza in a great sacrifice in their yearning for peace. The entire UN is in the grips of a monstrous Jew-hating fervor and intent on destroying Israel. So is Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, or any other group or individual that criticizes Israel. A nice piece of circular logic. The reason for criticizing Israel must be hatred of Jews. Therefore, the evidence of anti-Judaism is the criticism of Israel, which explains the criticism of Israel. They hate Jews, so they criticize Israel, and we know they hate Jews because they criticize Israel. This woman also claimed that the Vatican was run by a Nazi thug, but even a stop clock tells the right time twice a day. The Israeli spoke quite effectively, delivering everything as matter of fact. She soon realized that she had approached the wrong people, but the fact is that had we not had a pretty firm historical grounding, we would have got the worst of the discussion. Everything in current events that we could offer, she could gainsay, and she could additionally claim the superiority of direct knowledge. I found this Israeli puzzling, and it certainly occurred to me that she had received training for just such an occasion. After all, she had very good English, and it's fairly common for young Israelis to travel after completing military service. As indications of popular Israeli extremism continued to grow since then, however, it occurred to me that, trained or not, she may have believed most of what she uttered. It occurred to me that most people don't actually read the newspapers much, and most young people don't even watch the television news. Their views tend to be more rumor-oriented and more likely to be influenced by a sensationalist piece on YouTube. In other words, the existence of Haaretz or any other good, balanced reporting that might come out of Israel doesn't necessarily have much of an impact on the broader Israeli population. Part 3. Into the Heart of Hasbara. For some people, no doubt, Israeli Hasbara is a very familiar concept, an intimate part of the reality of the struggle for Palestinian freedom. Others are probably not familiar at all. Haspara is translated as public diplomacy. This refers to the deliberate manipulation of public opinion, commonly referred to as perception management, but also described as the theatre of power. Public diplomacy has evolved far beyond merely the work of public diplomats, to the extent that in NATO review, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Collins included the bombing of broadcasting stations as an act of public diplomacy. Collins differentiates between public diplomacy psyops, which is psychological operations such as staged demonstrations, public information and deception, and covert action. But this separation is totally unsustainable, suggesting, for example, that somehow public diplomacy, psyops, and public information do not involve deception. Indeed, although psyops may serve tactical purposes, psychological operations are increasingly a tool of public diplomacy. In fact, we live in a world where, for the developed states, the difference between a publicity stunt and a military operation is all but non-existent. Of course, this can lead to some pretty weird situations, such as is currently the case with regard to Syria. For the record, if I were Syrian, I have no doubt that I would oppose the Assad government, and I would have been one of those who opposed the reforms offered by Assad over a year ago. I say this with some chagrin because now the forces arrayed against the Assad regime are aligned with Western powers who would like nothing more than to inflict the same genocidal destruction and bloodletting on Syria that they inflicted on Iraq. That said, however, I would like to point out that the psyops-driven propaganda is going both ways in this war, and I am no less unconvinced by the footage of Islamic terrorists killing rabbits with gas and slavering, "This is what we will do to the infidel pig," than I'm unconvinced by people staging photo ops with carefully hand-buried cluster bombs, which are obviously a couple of decades past their use-by date. The most visible part of public diplomacy is public relations. The phrase public relations was invented by propagandist Edward Bernays as a replacement term for the term propaganda, which had taken on negative connotations. In other words, public relations is the propaganda term for propaganda. But as with Syrian propaganda, the Syria propaganda war, to understand Haspara, one must understand that it is public relations drawing on psychological operations and other covert action. You see, the US information environment, and indeed that of all Western states, is a big amorphous thing wherein people are subliminally induced to make political judgments based on the imagery of the entertainment media. The heroes are the US military and the CIA. The West are the good guys. They're noble, wise, and powerful. Vulnerable only to tricky underhandedness, unfathomable fanaticism, and, less so now than in past times, subversive brainwashing. And I think we should probably thank George Romero here for appropriating the trope of brainwashed mindlessness and turning it against the establishment, rather reducing its usefulness in Hollywood nowadays. The point is, however, that the power of this form of self-righteous Western chauvinism is that when matters of fact are reported or analysed, the reporter or analyst will, as a matter of course, try to fit the facts to the narrative that their gut tells them is right. And if they should be tempted to stray from that, there are many around them who will enforce compliance or, failing that, punish dissent and prevent repetition. So in the West, the backbone of the system is not deliberate misinformation, though of course political actors, including government agencies and private corporations, do spread misinformation when they can get away with doing so. In Israel, however, it is apparently insufficient to submerge the public in a collective arrogance, and the Israeli public must be drowned in actual lies. Further, these lies must be given substance by psychological operations. In this manner, Israelis can live, albeit rather willfully, in a kind of magical land of opposites. It is the same as our own beloved Orwellian system of doublethink and newspeak, but given more substance. Take, for example, Pellywood. Pellywood is the idea that Palestinians create fraudulent visual evidence of victims of Israeli violence. It began with an accusation made in 2005 that Palestinians had been running an incredibly sophisticated propaganda system of media manipulation dating back to 1982. There are two things that I think are worth noting about Pellywood claims. The first is that there are faked images of Palestinian casualties. Some presumably from misguided but well-meaning Palestinians wanting to drive home the reality of suffering by visual representation, but some is clearly likely to have been faked by Hasbara agents in order to exploit the Pellywood discourse. And just like PR is the propaganda term for propaganda, what this means is that there are fake fakes. These are propaganda fakes. They're not real fakes at all. The second thing is that the entire thrust of the Pellywood phenomenon is not to appeal to reason, but rather to block emotional reactions which are threatening to the fragile, rationalized sense of righteousness which seems to sustain most Israelis. To take the example of a recent video report entitled Photo Fraud in Gaza, the entire purpose was to inoculate the viewer from the emotional effects of seeing the results of violence. They do not claim that Israel does not kill children. They try to induce the viewer's mind a doubt as to the veracity of visual depictions of those dead children. At one point, they even cite the Palestinian Center for Human Rights as an authority regarding 4-year-old Mahmoud Sadala, whose corpse was kissed on the forehead by the weeping Egyptian Prime Minister. The video report claims that Mahmoud is a Hamas rocket victim whose death is wrongly attributed to an Israeli airstrike. A very quick peruse of PCHR's website, however, would reveal a long, long, continuing catalogue of Israeli violence and human rights abuse that includes killing of children in the latest 8-day assault on Gazans. The fact that the PCHR, unlike CNN and Reuters, did not attribute Mahmoud's death to an Israeli airstrike without proof only illustrates the reliability of their other reports of children killed by Israel. But that is reasoning, and this Hasbara is not meant to function on the level of rationality. It is designed in an economical and parsimonious fashion to give Zionists exactly the ammunition they need to maintain the delusion of righteousness, and no more. It is not designed to counter the ever more statistically overt fact of Israel's slow genocide. It is designed to allow people to dismiss statistics as unreliable. Strengthening the irrational narrative of Israeli righteousness is the prophylactic protection provided from dissenting opinions coming from the outside. This is achieved by accusing international organs and bodies of anti-Israeli bias, which is implicitly or explicitly attributed to an underlying hatred of Jews. There is much general accusation of media bias against Israel, but then there are those who claim the opposite. Both sides, for example, point to the omissions and distortions, but only one side can cite the systematic bias of subtly distorting language repeated hundreds of times over, and of the privilege, in objective and quantified terms, of one nationality over the other. The BBC, for example, is subject to very serious and sober criticism for its pro-Israeli bias based on quantitative criteria. In fact, the accusations of anti-Israeli bias on the BBC's part, based on discrete instances, simply cannot stand up against these countervailing accusations, which are not only based on more numerous instances, but have a coherent profundity lacking from the discourse of anti-Israeli bias. In other words, just As is the case with the child victims of Israeli violence, one can rightly or wrongly make emotive accusations of bias in individual instances of reportage, but a comprehensive and rigorous survey shows exactly the opposite. Nevertheless, one can see that for Israelis, it is almost an item of faith that the BBC hates Israel. So listen to this.
For BBC News Worldwide, this is Claire Bullockson for NewsHour. I'm reporting from BBC Studios in Gaza City, where the mood is decidedly downcast. I have just been informed that in addition to their unprecedented attacks on Palestinian men, women, and innocent livestock, the Israeli aggressors have managed to place their entire country directly in the line of fire. This is especially disheartening for the Palestinian people, for whom launching rockets is an important and meaningful cultural event.
And this.
I'm standing in the demolished city of Gaza. Right here, Jesus drank from the Holy Grail. But right there, the Israelis today are drinking the Palestinian blood.
Allah, 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 Allah.
This is Nadine. She's asleep right here. But her house was struck by missiles from right there. She's saying that the Israelis killed my husband and then raped my daughter.
What you can't see in that latter clip is that the Palestinian woman has subtitles and she is portrayed as complaining about noise and disruption to electricity and other rather trivial matters, while the BBC man is mistranslating her to make this great drama. Now, of course, this is satire and it is mocking the BBC, but this is about very serious stuff. We're talking about people dying, and the makers of this comedy sketch must have felt very confident that they would not be offending anyone by making this sort of claim. In other words, they must have felt pretty confident that the audience would really be more inclined to believe their portrayal of what the Palestinian woman is saying than to believe that there is actual death. They were conveying in quite clear terms that Israelis don't, in fact, kill Palestinians when they drop bombs on them. They just annoy them. Anyway, a similar perception of hostility to Israel as the Israelis see in the BBC applies to the United Nations. Now, the British 1939 White Paper on Palestine committed Britain to creating a binational state of Palestine. And rescinding that to create a Zionist state would have left the UK as being responsible and culpable for the deprivation of fundamental rights to Palestinians. So they handed it over to the United Nations to do that job. And in 1947, the UN Partition Plan, which was UN General Assembly Resolution 181, gave 54.5% of mandate Palestine to the Zionists to create the State of Israel. This 54.5% would have been a majority Palestinian state, not a majority Jewish state, which tends to illustrate how perverse this whole process was, especially from a body which enshrines, quote, the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples in Article 1. So, in order to create a, quote, Jewish state, the Zionists were already obliged to commit ethnic cleansing. But the fact that they preempted the UN does not absolve the United Nations of responsibility for a just and lasting solution. At the recent New York hearing of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, Vera Gowland-DeBus explained the UN's inevitable responsibility, after which Susan Akram described the regime under which Palestinian refugees are treated in the UN system. Now, I've got links to those as well, and I highly recommend them. The hyperlinks can be found in the transcript of this at the On Genocide blog. Now, when I write of the UN, or for that matter, when they're talking about the UN, that it's not the UN as a body or bodies, but rather the United Nations, which is constituted of member states, just as the name would imply, United Nations, you see. It is fair to say that the United Nations have not lived up to their obligations to Palestinians as a whole, or Palestinian refugees in particular. For 64 and a half years, they have failed to live up to their obligations to Palestinians, while generations are born, live, and die in a situation of enforced statelessness, oppressive occupation, and illegitimate material deprivation. The United Nations have not remedied this situation, which is the most clear-cut and long-standing issue with regard to the United Nations Charter, including issues of threats to the peace and to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The United Nations General Assembly and the United Nations Security Council have both authorized and called for action from member states on many occasions. Member states do not act, and the only underlying reason, even if the immediate reason may be fear of retaliation, can be that fulfilling the obligation to restore inalienable Palestinian rights would be harmful to the Zionist state of Israel. You couldn't get more pro-Israel than that. That is the stance of the United Nations. That, of course, does not prevent organizations like United Nations Watch from accusing the United Nations of anti-Semitism, or, quote, the aiding and abetting of anti-Semitism through an infrastructure of manifestly one-sided and irrational UN measures designed to demonize the Jewish state. All attacks on Zionism are defined as being anti-Semitic because they are attacks on the Jewish nature of Israel. Well, which again goes back to that circular logic. Of course, forcefully telling Israelis over and over again that almost the entire world is against them is probably rather harmful to their mental health, especially when it is presented as coming from an irrational hatred of Jews. Imagine believing that the majority of the world actually hated your entire ethnic group, believing that billions of people just hate Jews for some unfathomable reason. There are dissonant notes, however. The proximity and humanity of Palestinians, and the visibility of those things that keep them invisible, and the undeniable and undeniably unjust material inequity, and the creeping annexation of Israeli settlements, none of these can be reconciled with the narrative of Israeli righteousness, nor Israel's persecution by a hostile and hateful world. But cognitive dissonance only fuels stridency and ever more desperate nationalization. I think ever more desperate nationalism is what I meant to say. Of course, this is all fragile and unsustainable. The more extreme positions taken by Israeli people are symptomatic of a failing ethos, a failing society. The more that Israelis display animus, the more they alienate international opinion. What might happen next, I cannot say, but this phase is nearly over. In the current international regime, it is only a matter of time before Israel is officially ostracized and sanctioned. And staving off that day would require a moderation which it seems that Israel is no longer capable of exercising. Israel may have found a way to hold its own on the demographic front by settling ultra-Orthodox Jews in the West Bank. Because they have such large families, they are currently, despite Israel's often rather paranoid-sounding claims that it is losing the demographic war, they are outbreeding the Palestinians at the moment. But that's the demographic front. On the ideological front, everything is crumbling. As the old cliche goes, things that can't go on forever don't. Part 4. The End. I probably make more references to George Orwell's 1984 than I should. Some people get obsessed with that book, but I don't think it's entirely unreasonable to be so. It's not in any way ultimate nor omniscient. It is, in fact, quite little, but word for word, it contains the most useful analysis of politics that I'm aware of. You see, it is not akin to Huxley's Brave New World, but rather adopts the guise of dystopian fantasy for its satirical effect. Orwell deliberately says to the reader, if you want to misinterpret this work, here is how you may do so, and he actually mocks them for that simultaneously. Perhaps he was serving his own ego better than serving humanity at this point, but who can say what his real motives were? It is not as if he hadn't made himself plain, if less comprehensively and powerfully so, in other writings. The point is that I'm getting at, however. The point is that 1984 described contemporary Western society, not some possible future Soviet-style totalitarian society. Putting aside the science fiction ephemera, 1984 described a society in which the manipulation of the meaning of words and language produced a fundamental utilitarian distortion of information which was aiming, with the perfection of newspeak, to become limitless, meaning it would no longer be constrained by any form of external reality. Orwell didn't suggest that this was the case, nor that it was even possible. In fact, he strongly implies that it is completely unnecessary, but he makes it the ultimate aim of newspeak. As a journalist, his central character is both a primary victim of and a significant promulgator of newspeak. The central fact, though, is that in 1984, direct lies are allegorical. They are meant to represent the way in which we in the party, meaning the most educated part of the population, which inevitably includes journalists and academics, miscontextualize in order to create lies without actually having to say those lies until they become too commonplace to question. In our society, there are instances where the sophistication of deception and doublethink exceeds Orwell's model. But increasingly, our propaganda organs are sinking below the level of Orwellianism. Increasingly, leaders simply lie, and stenographers, posing as journalists, convey those lies to the public. And I'm not talking about the big lie technique, which has never gone out of fashion. I'm talking about simple, routine falsities, which are completely reliant on the assumption that no one is actually going to be rude enough to point out the lie. Just look at Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. One researcher counted 533 lies and points out that media fact-checkers catch him out repeatedly without that seeming to make any difference. What he fails to point out is that every time the media treat Romney as a reliable and respectable source of information, rather than confronting him with his record of dishonesty every time he makes a claim, they are themselves perpetuating a lie, and, incidentally, perpetuating every lie that Romney has made that the audience has not specifically seen debunked. The result does not look like Orwell's depiction of 1948 Britain. Moral inversions and blind emotion were used to tailor facts to fit a predetermined model of significance. in that in 1948 or 1984, it actually looks more like 1944 Germany, or 1984 East Germany, for that matter. What does this Western imperial? What does this mean that Western imperialism, like Zionism, is nearly at an end? If so, is the failure of the propaganda system a symptom or a cause or both? I don't know. I do know that writing off the US Empire, which people have been doing for at least half a century, is really dumb. Maybe the Empire has run its course, but US imperialists are not stupid, and they didn't run the world for the last 70 years or so without knowing a thing or two about propaganda and mass psychology. You see, if the blatant lies seem sub-Orwellian, they are existing alongside that which is Orwellian and that which is super-Orwellian. Looking at the top 25 censored stories just released by Project Censored, one can see all types in action. The blatant lies that surely can't be suppressed forever include the US working with Al-Qaeda in Syria and the true extent of the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. You could take these as the signs of a decaying system, and I personally tend towards that belief. But maybe it is people like me who are deluding ourselves, whilst the vast majority of our fellow human beings, particularly in the most powerful countries, are far too busy with their iPads and 3D blockbusters. Maybe the blatant lies are because some people in the political and corporate landscape really think they've broken through that barrier that external reality places on their newspeak. We'll see, I guess. I'm going to leave you with David Rovick's singing They're Building a Wall, which is a singularly appropriate song. When Vladimir Jabotinsky wrote that the State of Israel would need to oppose Arabs with an iron wall of Jewish bayonets, he was, of course, referring to military power, but he was also implicitly referring to a mental wall with bayonets of paranoia and hatred. David Rovick sings about that mental wall as well as the physical wall which they're building through occupied Palestinian territory.
And 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide, now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep distant the chambers of gas from the bulldozers' gunships and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and honor defiled, to remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distance the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost, land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people upon their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.